Good afternoon, everyone. I am Hank Jones, and you are listening to Hank Jones Poly Sports here on Global Patriot Radio at blogtalkradio.com. That, of course, is the theme from Harry O, one of my favorite 1970s shows. Great stuff. And, of course, it's Wednesday, February 23rd, 2022. I know, I like to say 2022, but my wife doesn't like it when I say that because she says, you know, then you're making it sound like 2020, comma, T-O-O. I get it, but it doesn't feel comfortable anyway. 2022 just doesn't sound right. It sounds like you're counting something. Oh, okay. Every Monday here at Global Patriot Radio, the Vito Esposito Show, featuring Vito and Big Al. Tuesdays, Eric is in with the Cross and Crescent discussion. Those are both at 6 o'clock Eastern Time. Thursdays, Paul Sutliff is in with the Sutliffian Report, also at 6 o'clock. Fridays, you get Andrew Herod with Conservative Casual Friday, usually at noon Eastern. And then Saturday nights, Minister Usama Dakduk and the Beautiful Christie, revealing the truth about Islam at 10 p.m. And then Sundays, Eric's back with Real Interfaith Dialogue. Always good stuff here at Global Patriot Radio. And on every day but Wednesday, great stuff. How's that sound? If you want to contact me, off show, hjpsports1980@gmail.com. On Twitter, at hpolysports. On Facebook, just type in Hank Jones Polysports. In Electric Hankland Studios, my wife is here. My cute little Aussie is here. She was right around just a second ago. Just adorable little miniature Australian Shepherd. Just adorable. That's all I can say. We got two of the crew coming in today. Brother Tommy's coming in, talking about some basketball and some ponies. Hawkeye Michael come in with some crucial insights into what's happening in Ukraine. Don't get me wrong, Brother Tommy's stuff is crucial too, but it's not anything that should make you afraid. Whereas what's happening in Ukraine, yeah, well, that could not be good. That could be really, really bad, just depending. Okay, let's get right to the obituaries. Yes, we shall. Okay. Last week, in Boynton Beach, Florida, Bernie Madoff's sister and her husband were found dead in an apparent murder-suicide. Sandra Weiner, age 87, was the sister of Bernie Madoff, who died last year in prison. He was 82. He was the fraudster who was sentenced to 150 years in prison after concocting, quote, the largest Ponzi scheme in history, estimated at $64.8 billion. I'll tell you what, folks in the government are saying, hold my beer on that largest Ponzi scheme thing. Just saying. And let's see, last Wednesday, the death of USAC and CART Hall of Fame driver Roger Rager at age 73. Now, when I first saw this, I thought it said Roger, which had me looking all over for Leslie Nielsen clips from the movie Airplane, False Alarm. Anyway, Roger Rager passed away in Minnesota. He had retired thereafter from racing after being inaugurated into the Sprint Car Hall of Fame in 2009. Actually ran an RV park in Pequot Lakes, Minnesota in his retirement. That sounds like fun, actually. Little RV park. R&B singer David Tyson, he was in the Manhattans. For my big sister who's listening and my brother Tommy, no, not what you're thinking with Manhattans. There's a group, the Manhattans. He passed away last Thursday at 62. They had several hits. The biggest was that 1976 Kiss and Say Goodbye. He's also the brother of Ron Tyson, who had a stint or two with the Temptations. We also lost that day Roddy Haley, age 57. He ran on the gold medal winning 4x400 medal relay teams at the Pan Am Games in 1987 and also the World Track and Field team. He broke into prominence, I guess, as a freshman. He was at Arkansas. He ran as a freshman. He won the 400 meters with a pretty damn blistering time, 44.2 seconds. That's still fast now, but in those days and for a freshman, yeah, it was absolutely smoking, no doubt. He also won NCAA titles indoors in the 500 meters, two of them actually. This is kind of sad. Last Friday, Los Angeles police discovered the body of actress Lindsay Pearlman. She had been reported missing on the 16th, 2 days before. She's only 43. Cause of death is pending per investigation by the coroner. She appeared in General Hospital. Chicago Justice, which was a very short-lived spinoff of the Chicago One Chicago franchise, which Chicago Fire, Chicago PD, Chicago Med. Chicago Justice made about a half-season run. She was also on the show American Housewife. That was a pretty funny show sometimes. She was born in Chicago. She was also a member of the Second City Conservatory. Yes, that Second City. It's a training center for Second City theaters, made most famous, of course, by the show, which came to be known as SCTV. Let's see, Eugene Levy, Mark Short, Dave Thomas, Catherine O'Hara, Andrea Martin, and, of course, the late, great Harold Ramis and John Candy. Hawkeye Mike is going to be on later. He and I used to watch that in college. Great stuff. Absolutely great stuff. Now, Saturday, we had one loss and technically one game, if you want to call it that, sort of, I guess. First, a Canadian Hall of Fame hockey player, a coach, executive, Emil Francis. He passed away at age 95. And then we saw the Arkanside, or suicide, if you will.
Bullshit.
Yeah, of Jean-Luc Brunel at the age of 75 in his French jail cell. According to several of the accusers in the Jeffrey Epstein-Ghislaine Maxwell case, he was a trafficker or procurer for Epstein Island, I guess you want to call it. He's also, quote, a model and talent scout. Yeah, not hard to depict which one of those was a loss. Sunday, we lost Jamal Edwards. He was British author, fashion, media, and music entrepreneur. He's only 31 after a sudden illness. Very sad. Despite all his entrepreneurial pursuits, probably his most important work was with Prince's Trust. That's Prince Charles's charity that works with troubled youth to help them get their lives back on track and then puts them on track to set up their own businesses, which is pretty, pretty impressive. Past Monday, we lost Russian geologist Yevgeny Kozlovsky at age 82. He was active in Soviet Union politics, I guess, sort of. He served as Minister of Geology from 1975 to 1989. Now, that seems pretty boring. I chose this particular obituary because the term Minister of Geology, I like that. I really do. Or as Jesse Ventura would say when he was with the WWF, I like that, McMahon. I think that's cool. We need a Minister of Geology around here. I mean, I think it would be rock solid. It's been reported that Zoe Sozo Bethel, who was Miss Alabama 2021 for America Strong, she passed away the 18th from injuries that she sustained in an accident on the 10th of this month. Only 27, man. In addition to modeling, though, she was also a pro-life advocate. She was most recently Right Side Broadcasting Network and worked previously with Turning Point USA, Liberty University, and Project Veritas. Turning Point did a nice little tribute to her with a video and said this, "We are so honored to have known Zoe Sozo Bethel. She has been a pillar in the conservative movement, always moving with grace, elegance, and wisdom." Yeah, very sad. I mean, 27, that's just too early. Former Fox News and CNN political analyst and commentator. Oh, and by the way, the guy who ran Walter Mondale's hugely unsuccessful 1984 presidential campaign, Bob Beckel, passed away Monday at 73. This guy could find controversy pretty easily. Had some alleged racial comments, had some addiction issues. He's a former co-host of The Five on Fox. His claim to fame probably was that he nearly choked to death on a piece of shrimp at a Fox News reception in 2011 before he was rescued by Roger Ailes and his co-host, Eric Bolling. Yeah, not not a good start to a reception, that's for sure. Here's another loss from last Saturday. Gary Brooker passed away from cancer at age 76. Now, while many won't recognize that name, Hawkeye Mike did. Gary Brooker co-founded a British group called the Paramounts in 1962. His co-founder was guitarist Robin Trower. So what did they go on to do? They went on to found Procol Harum. And Gary Brooker co-wrote their biggest hit, A Whiter Shade of Pale. He was a vocalist on that major hit, as well as the other song, Conquistador, not Conquistador. When you listen to the song, it says Conquistador. That appeared on the band's debut album, but then was released as a single in 1972. Never reached, you know, the peak that Whiter Shade did. In fact, the day that it reached number 16 on the chart, it was 5 years to the day after Whiter Shade of Pale reached its peak of number 5. He was also heavily involved as a supporter of Countryside Alliance. It's a British organization, promotes rural-oriented issues, farming, rural services, small businesses, and field sports. What are field sports? Hiking, backpacking, camping, hunting, shooting, archery, falconry. Yeah, falconry. Canyoning and water sports like canoeing, kayaking, etc. Good for him, man, being involved in that kind of stuff. Outdoor pursuits are very important. He also appeared on albums and tours by George Harrison, Ringo Starr, Bill Wyman. And he played on Eric Clapton's Another Ticket album. Personally, will never forgive for that insanely stupid single it produced, I Can't Stand It. That's the name of the song. Yeah, I Can't Stand It. Terrible song. But at least Gary Brooker didn't sing it, didn't write it. He just played organ, provided backup vocals. And no, that awesome church-sounding Baroque-style organ you hear on A Whiter Shade of Pale is not Gary Brooker. He did provide piano and, of course, that awesome and oft-repeated and imitated vocal. I heard someone try to karaoke one time. Now, look, while I've often gotten drunk enough to do karaoke, I have never been stupid enough to try and recreate something that's really good, like a song like that. I mean, really, that stupidity is only surpassed by people at karaoke who get up and do like a Hendrix song and then play air guitar while doing it. Yeah. Oh, the answer, by the way, no. The answer to that is no. Figure it out. You know what I mean. Yesterday, we lost German mime artist Eberhard Kubi at age 85. No cause was listed. I guess, whatever it was, he couldn't vocalize any symptoms. Okay, sorry. Ouch. Let's get to some news. Ostensibly, that's why you're here. And, of course, for my twist on it. The three men convicted in the killing of Ahmaud Arbery near Brunswick, Georgia. They have now also been convicted under federal hate crime statutes. Travis and Greg McMichael, along with William Roddy Bryan, were convicted previously for the killing in Georgia state court. They used text messages and social media posts, along with testimony from people who either saw behavior or heard comments from the three men over the past several years. Frankly, this was a no-brainer. It really was. Really, the only fly in the ointment, if there is one, is the involvement of Attorney General Merrick Garland. I mean, grandstanding is one thing. Pretending to be some race vengeance crusader is a bit much. Still, man, these three guys are scumbags. They literally took off after this young man in some sort of like hunting posse. I can only imagine the terror this guy felt. I don't want to say kid, he was 25, but the terror that he felt and probably complete disbelief. I mean, he's probably thinking during this, what in the hell have I gotten myself into? Why am I here? How am I here? I'm walking through the neighborhood doing a jog and I don't know, you know, I'm never going to understand what guys like this are thinking when they're tracing it, you know, chasing after this young man. And I never bought their excuses. And frankly, the local police trying to cover it up or excuse it. Look, for her part, his mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, was not happy with Department of Justice prosecutors. Why? They chose to ignore it. Not ignore it, but they were willing to accept plea deals from the McMichaels in exchange for serving their time in federal prison. Now, no, federal prison is not like Henry Hill would have had us believe in Goodfellas, but it is considerably better than state court or, you know, or state prison. You know, in any event, that's three people we have to feed. No doubt they will get, like, high-speed internet, cable TV, special diets. Most folks can only dream of having. Look, I don't favor the death penalty. But in this particular case, I really don't favor three guys acting as vigilantes having any sort of say in their punishment and sentencing. That's just not okay with me. I'm sorry. I mean, really, the only at this point, may Ahmaud Arbery just feel God's comfort and rest in peace knowing that his family has some measure of justice. And hopefully his family could be somewhat comforted knowing that despite local cowboys not pursuing this case initially, at least some measure of justice has been served. I'm not sure true justice gets served in a case like this. I'm really not. Every time I've read about this story, nothing has changed in terms of, you know, the senselessness. The senselessness of it, the ruthlessness of it, and frankly, like I said, the local cowboys almost categorically pushing it under the rug, acting like that there was nothing there. You know, I don't know. I mean, I'm glad this is resolved, but in a way it's not. And it's just sad. I mean, this kid lost his life just for being where somebody didn't want him, not for being where he wasn't supposed to be or not for being where he shouldn't go. He happened to be where someone just didn't want him. And that's awful. I'm sorry. That's just awful. Medina Spirit has been stripped of victory in last year's Kentucky Derby, elevating Mandaloon to the top spot. My guess, those roses are long since decrepit, unless they dry them for posterity or like a potpourri arrangement. Anyway, only two horses have had their Kentucky Derby victory taken away much later in the 147-year history. The first was Dancer's Image in 1968. Yeah, the 2019 race was changed due to a disqualification in the initial post-race review, but that was right there. Maximum Security got bumped out, and Country House got the roses. That wasn't months later, though. And I guess that's the distinction. Country House actually got the roses. They suspended trainer Bob Baffert. I'm good with that, I guess. But come on, Medina Spirit just died. It ain't like Mandaloon will know the difference. And what are they going to do, a medal ceremony? What exactly does that do for bettors? I don't know. I know the winner's purse was already held up, so Mandaloon's owners get that. And Bob Baffert was suspended for 90 days and fined $7,500. Now, his attorney says he will appeal the ruling. What the hell for? He's probably already spent 50 or 100 grand in attorney's fees. Take the damn Triple Crown season off, Bob Baffert, and come back drug-free. I mean, your horses, too, you know. I mean, California has said it will honor the suspension. But here, Baffert's already run several horses in Derby prep races this year out there. So, yeah, back to the bettors. I'm not sure how this is affected. Brother Tommy will know when I have him on shortly. For Chicago sports fans, the Chicago Blackhawks have parted ways with Bobby Hull. Now, you youngsters, you will not know Bobby Hull. You probably will. You know Brett Hull. But for us that grow up in Chicago in the heyday of Chicago hockey, and I don't mean the Stanley Cup, but just the glory days of some of those guys, Bobby Hull was legend, coupled with the deaths of Stan Mikita and Tony Esposito. Again, I've talked about this before. No relation to our Vito Esposito, despite numerous claims by numerous people. This leaves the Blackhawks with none of their 1960s and 70s era players as part of their ambassador crew. Not that it really matters, given the team was levied a $2 million fine after several unsavory allegations, forced the resignations of general manager Stan Bowman, VP of operations Al McIsaac, head coach Joel Quenneville, plus the firing of their Rockford AHL affiliate coach last November. Of their original ambassadors, only Dennis Savard remains. Yeah, Savard came to the Blackhawks in 1980. It was past the time when the Hawks were cool. Jim Belushi waving at people in the stands on TV was not the cool era for the Blackhawks. Sorry. Basically, when Chicago Stadium stopped selling Meisterbrow half courts, the Blackhawks were no longer, quote, cool. Because at that point, they were no longer even semi-blue collar. The Rosemont Horizon, the United Center, forget it. Yeah, look, it's still fun to watch them when they don't absolutely suck. But there's no longer the dump bars where you'd go in for a slew of shot and a beer for a buck rounds before the game and after the game. I mean, look, they sell microbrews at their games now. That's fine in Los Angeles or Seattle, maybe even New York or Atlanta. Chicago, no. Kansas City, no. Detroit, hell no. I mean, what's next, man? Drinking Manhattans in the club suites at White Sox games or wine spritzers at St. Louis Cardinals games? There's one problem when you mix politics and sports. It's not the sports people, although it often is, but it's the politicians. I mean, too many of them, first of all, throw like girls and think that the forward pass was named after Bill Clinton. Here's what the politicians see it as: tax base and voters, maybe, and a place to be rich and elite with their friends in the political ruling class. It's not about merit to them or intelligence or even ability. It's about cronyism. You ever notice how, like, big media, really all of big left, goes after, like, Dan Quayle or George Bush or Sarah Palin because they say they're stupid, their perceived stupidity? And meanwhile, they're actually interviewing people like AOC and Bernie Sanders and proffering them as economic discoveries and geniuses. Then they actually air those interviews. I mean, at what point will someone realize that having Barack Obama throw out the first pitch at a baseball game is a bad idea? The ceremonial aspect maybe isn't worth it. Did anybody ever see that? Pull up that video of him throwing out the first pitch. I literally, a couple years ago, said he throws like Cindy Brady, and Vito said I better apologize, but not to Barack Obama. I better apologize to Cindy Brady, and I did. It was terrible. It was an embarrassment. Look, like I've said, get rid of the anthem. Get rid of the halftime show. No more celebrity guest pickers who don't know the difference between the goal line and the blue line. No more halftime shows. No more ceremonial first pitches. Unless and until they can limit it to actual former players who won't look stupid, just don't do it. Look, someone giving money to a college or a stadium, that should never give someone the right to denigrate the game itself. I mean, we should never have to ever be worried about tuning in and seeing Bernie Sanders trying to kick a ceremonial field goal. God forbid they ever get Maxine Waters out to shoot the ceremonial free throw. Oh, and speaking earlier of Dan Quayle, by the way, no, he was not an athletic embarrassment. While Barack Obama went to the golf course and cruised around on a cart for 18 holes, Dan Quayle is an actual golfer. For those that don't know, he played on the golf team at DePaul University in Indiana. One of his teammates was none other than Mark Rolfing. Now, you golfers will know, he himself is a pro. He's a commentator on TV. By the way, his mom was married after Mark's father passed away. His mom was married to a friend of our family, so a friend of my dad's, business partner. In fact, they took me and my brothers and some buddies to our first Cubs game, Ivanhoe on North Clark Street, not too far from Wrigley Field. Good times, good times. No Meisterbrow half courts, not for this 8-year-old at the time. Yeah, that didn't come until I was like 11 or 12. And even then, that was only for the empties, for our beer can collections. Remember that? Everybody remember that, collecting beer can collections? That was cool. I like that. Anyway, so, sound like Jen Psaki. Anyway, circling back to the Blackhawks, looks like they're in a kind of a rough spot. They're currently seventh in the Western Conference Central Division. I mean, it happens. It's all cyclical. A few years, they'll be competitive again. But even that's kind of a last vestiges theme. Because remember when sports had conferences and divisions that made sense? You know, like Western Conference, Eastern Conference, Central Division, Eastern Division, Southern Division, whatever. Now, you're going to believe it. The NHL is still two conferences, Eastern and Western. So far, so good. The two divisions, the Atlantic. Okay, kind of stupid, but understandable. I mean, the eastern side of our country does border the Atlantic Ocean, so I get that. Even Canada. Eh? So please tell me how the hell the Toronto Maple Leafs end up in the Atlantic Division, or the frigging Detroit Red Wings? How do they end up in the Atlantic Division? Oh, but guess what the other Eastern Conference Division is called? The Metropolitan Division. What in the actual hell? Metropolitan Division? Beyond. I mean, beyond contrived and pretentious. I don't need to mention stupid. I mean, at least the Western Conference has Central and Pacific. Again, not sure how the Calgary Flames or Edmonton Oilers end up in the Pacific Division. But at least it ain't something stupid like the Cosmopolitan Division or the Silicon Valley Division. God, I hope no league executives heard that, because I may have just created a monster saying that. Which I basically did, by the way, with this whole item. This was supposed to be about the Chicago Blackhawks, which I was supposed to circle back to and didn't. Oh, well. Okay, I know I talk a lot about transgender sports issues. Here's kind of a non-sports transgender story that sort of lays out the whole charade, if you will. Look, I'm not saying there's no such thing, but this is about a transgender woman named Hannah Tubbs. Tubbs pleaded guilty to molesting a 10-year-old girl in a woman's bathroom in 2014. Here's a little more from Yahoo, because this is really, if you're going to hurl, hold your ears. Explicit Los Angeles jailhouse recordings of Hannah Tubbs, the 26-year-old trans child molester who received a slap on the wrist last month after pleading guilty to molesting a 10-year-old girl in 2014, depict her admitting it was wrong to attack a little girl, but gloating over the light punishment. She boasted nothing would happen to her after pleading guilty due to Democrat District Attorney George Gascon's policies, and laughed that she won't have to go back to prison or register as a sex offender. Said in one recording, "I'm going to do it. Plead guilty. They're going to stick me on probation, and it's going to be dropped. It's going to be done. I won't have to register. Won't have to do nothing." Yeah. Now, if you want to call him that sad excuse, George Gascon is coming under some heavy fire for it. But let's make no mistake. A lot of this is a ruse. When you hear about those recordings, you wonder why the person went through getting the surgery or whatever. And it may not even have had surgery. That's the thing. They don't even delineate between those who have had surgery or not, hormonal treatments or not. I mean, in some cases, it's just some dude putting on a wig and some lipstick and calling himself a woman. Now, a guy I know, a friend of mine, sort of a friend from near my hometown where I grew up, he said something eight years ago maybe on Facebook. He talked about LGBTQ and all that. He said, why are they including the T in there? And he's all for that, the LGB part of it. But he says, you know, the T, he goes, so you look at over the years, I mean, Eddie Murphy, Hugh Grant, a couple others that have been busted for going after, you know, trying to pick up prostitutes who turn out to be trans. As he said, the whole trans thing is a deception to make people think you're a woman and to try and trick people. Think about that. I mean, there's that place in New Orleans that used to have trans strippers. And I admit, I went in there with a huge group of people at a convention there one time, you know. It is what it is. There were others, too. There were normal strippers, if you want to call it normal strippers. A lot of normal strippers out there. But, yeah, I mean, they try to fool you. It's the whole thing is a deception. And what's sad about that, there are people who are, I guess you'd say, trapped. I mean, some people, dear friends who I grew up with, they had a grandchild who was trans and who committed suicide. I mean, it was a real struggle. And so when you see stories like this, it really just denigrates and dumps on those who are actually experiencing what it is to be truly trans, I guess you'd say. I mean, that's just, and hearing this, I mean, doesn't have to register on the sex registry. I mean, all that, what the hell? Enough of that. Pro football, looks like the Kansas City Chiefs have released former Iowa Hawkeye linebacker Anthony Hitchens in order to save $8.4 million against the salary cap. He spent his first 4 years in the league with the Dallas Cowboys, went to the Chiefs as a free agent in 2018. Head coach Andy Reid and general manager Bruce Veach, they heaped praise on Hitchens. But I guess drafting linebackers in the second round of the last two drafts probably precluded them about making it about on-field performance and more strictly about money. I hope it comes back to bite them. I really do. Yeah, Hitchens was part of he was a group of awesome linebackers from the mid-2010s. Him, James Morris, Christian Kirksey, and then later Josie Jewell, Ben Neiman, and Bo Bauer, Cole Fisher. He was in the original group with those folks. Yeah, linebacker is one position the Hawkeyes rarely need to worry about, Anthony Hitchens being a prime example. Then the Hawkeye men's basketballers, they're on a bit of a roll. Rose to number 25 in the AP poll after got a 13-point win over number 18 Ohio State at Columbus. Then last night, the Hawks, they went into East Lansing and obliterated Michigan State, 86-60. Yeah, Michigan State's got problems, make no mistake. That's still a couple of quad one wins. At this point, I would say splitting their last two regular season games, or their last four, but going 2-2, I'd say they're in at that point into the NCAAs. A win or two in the Big Ten tournament never hurts. But Fran McCaffrey, he's never made it to Sunday. Only once has he gotten into the semifinals on Saturday. Still, I mean, after the home loss to Michigan last Thursday, I certainly didn't see these two games coming in as wins. We're going to get more on Michigan in a bit. Brother Tommy's going to come on. So we have two bizarre incidents in college basketball the past couple of days. First, yesterday, Dan Hurley, UConn's head coach, got tossed in their game against Villanova. He got teed up twice. First, he slammed his fist on the scorer's table. He thought they missed a foul call, and he thought it was egregious. So while I understand what he did, it's an understandable technical as well. I mean, whether or not officials miss a call or make a bad call, you don't go over and slam your hand on the scorer's table. I mean, as Eric Roberts said in Pope of Greenwich Village, you can't do that. The second technical, now this was assessed after he turned to Dan Hurley, turned to the crowd. Crowd started to get a little loud, and he turned to the crowd and he implored them. He started waving his arms to get the crowd to get loud. What the hell? I mean, I don't get that. Now, the other incident was last weekend, was moments after the Michigan-Wisconsin game. Michigan head coach Juwan Howard, open hand shot at Wisconsin assistant coach Joe Krabenhoff. Yeah, I'd have gone after him for that name, too. How do you pronounce that? His fist was cocked for another shot, by the way. Luckily, Michigan assistant coaches and players held him off. But he took, I mean, go look at it. Just took an open swipe. Really not cool. So, you know, I don't know. He's got a fine coming. He's suspended. But we're going to bring in someone who's going to tell us what he thinks, because he played basketball more than I did anyway. He was a really good basketball player, actually. So, you know who's coming. Dedicating the song to coming in. Whoa, Black Betty, Bama Lamb. Whoa, Black Betty, Bama Lamb. She's from Birmingham. Bama Lamb, way down in Alabama. Bama Lamb, the way she shake that thing. Bama Lamb, boy, she make me sing. Bama Lamb, whoa, Black Betty. Bama Lamb, whoa, Black Betty. Bama
lamp, you really get me high. Bam a lamp, you
know
where
I'm at.
Bam a lamp, she's always ready. Bam a lamp, whoa, Black Betty. Bam a lamp, whoa, Black Betty. Bam a lamp, whoa, Black.
Brother Tommy.
Wow, we
up?
Got the long version there. Not much.
Yeah.
I got to correct you. I got to correct you real quick though. Last night's game was not in East Lansing. It was in Iowa City.
Oh, it was? I thought it was in East Lansing.
Yes, and you failed to mention. Last night was the night that they retired Devin Marble, but more importantly, in my world anyways, Luca Garza's jersey. They had him there during the game, talking with the announcers and stuff. It was really a really cool show.
I was working last night, folks, so that's why I only get caught highlights today. So
yeah,
what,
they did
what
Luke Garza thing and Devin Marble the whole nine yards. Just a FYI.
Is Michigan State, are they just in a funk or are they just not that good?
Five of the last six. I mean, they were a top 10 team. They are in a funk. Izzo, who I happen to like, most people don't, could not have been more congratulatory towards Iowa and our coach, which I disagree with. But he said that they flat out handed it to us, but he acknowledged that they're having problems. They're just going, we're doing the opposite of what they're doing. They're hitting a slump at the worst time to hit a slump. They're arguably not going to make the tournament unless they turn things around. And we're hot when we're supposed to be hot. So it was a truly glorious game, especially because Garza was there. His father was there. Marble was there. Obviously, they retired Roy Marble. I might have said Devin Marble.
Did they retire Devin's number two or not?
No. I might have said that. I said that wrong. They retired Roy's and then a couple of guys that I've never even heard of, probably 50, 60 guys. Cruz, I want to say. I don't know. A couple of names I didn't know. Hawkeye Mike will know when he comes on. He'll
yeah.
Know.
Okay, cool. So what'd you think? Okay, here is Juwan Howard's – his fine is $40,000, and he's out the rest of the regular season. What do you think? What do you think?
Well, the regular season, just so you know, it's doesn't make sense because the way I read it, he's eligible for the Big Ten tournament. Now, since everyone plays in the Big Ten tournament, I do not know how that would not constitute regular season. But the way I understand it, he's eligible for the regular season. I thought the fine was a joke. I did the numbers. I had heard once he was worth $100 million. I looked at it, and the consensus is he's got a net worth of $80 million. So that $40,000 fine is equivalent to say you have $1,000 in the bank being fined 50 cents. Those numbers are proportionally
okay.
Literally 50 cents. So I thought the fine was a joke. I think the real I think justice would have been done if he was gone for the rest of the season. I'm not saying fire him. That's Michigan's business to do or not to do. That's their thing. But I think justice would have been served being out for the whole season. Because, as we all know, it's not the first time. He had that run-in with Turgeon last
yeah.
year. And I didn't know this stuff till recently because I bought into the narrative last year that he was such a stand-up guy and stuff. And I talked to one of my buddies. He's like, you're an idiot. You don't follow it? And I'm like, no, I don't follow it. He's like, oh, this guy's thug all over. He's thug across the board. And then I looked into it. Yeah, he talks to the opposing team's players, which is you're allowed to do, but it's considered a, you know, faux pas. You know, it's unwritten rule. You don't do that. And so I don't think the punishment fit the crime in the sense that I think the punishment was much too lenient. But, you know, I think, and I don't want to take it down this path, but, and you all can do the arithmetic on this. I think if it was a less notable school like in Iowa, Fran McCaffrey, I guarantee you Fran McCaffrey would be out for the season, if not more. And, you know, Fran McCaffrey happens to be white, and he's got a hot temper. But I'll tell you what, when he does things one-tenth of this, the media blows it up like – and I'm not a Fran McCaffrey apologist, believe me. I don't have much good to say about him. But it just, to me, is like unequal justice. That's all.
Yes.
But
Greg Gard, the Wisconsin coach, got a $10,000 fine. two Michigan players and one Wisconsin player each got suspended for one game. So at least
Greg Gard, however, Greg Gard is no saint.
Yeah, exactly.
He is no saint. He is no saint. The, for what he lets, what's his name, Davison, I think it's Davison, the inventor or the lover of the Nutcracker Suite.
Yeah,
you get my drift?
Yeah.
The fact that he lets that happen.
What Brother Tommy just said is code word for Brad Davison from Wisconsin likes to hit guys in the area where guys don't like to be hit. And he gets away.
And you know
with
what? I saw so many shots of it. I don't even think he's doing it for a tactical advantage. I got to the point thinking this guy's just a fucking pervert. I mean, there's so many shots of him grabbing other guys' nuggets. I'm like, what the hell, man? I get it. 3-point deficit. But, I mean, you're doing it with a 20-point lead. Come on. There's more to it. There's more to it, Brad. Do you like packages? And, hey, that's your business. Speaking of LGBTQ or whatever, I've often thought, do you ever think the vowels get a little jealous?
Yeah, I know they do.
I mean, talk about discrimination. Not one vowel amongst the bunch. If I was a vowel, I'd be outraged. I would form a group. I want a vowel in LGBTQ.
You know what, though? Let's not go, because I don't know what – I don't want to know what they'd stand for. So I just don't want to know.
Yeah, a few more drinks, and maybe your imagination will run wild, and who knows? I think we could come up with a few things, especially A. Come on, A. Come on, easy. O. I could do a lot with O. Without even any alcohol in my system, I could do a lot with O. So, no, I think the fouls have a right to be outraged.
Yeah, that's true. So here's what one thing Howard said. He said he was mad about Wisconsin calling timeouts when they did. My
Correct.
Father-in-law made a good point. Shouldn't he be mad at Chris Weber for the timeout he called? Remember when Weber called a timeout when they didn't have
He's got obviously he's got a phobia with timeouts. I mean, it started, 30 years ago or whatever the fuck it was. But you know what the deal was? And I played basketball, and I'm telling you, he started the faux pas. Guard did not react well, but he started. And I'll tell you why. 30 seconds left. He's got his guys in there. They're doing a full court press. Guard's got his second stringers in there. And he's like, I'm not going to let these guys get embarrassed. I'm going to call a timeout and tell them what we're going to do to handle the full court press. But when you got a 15-point deficit with 30 seconds left, you don't do a full court press. So he started it. Now, Guard did grab his arm. And, you know, like I said, Guard's no saint either. But whatever, Guard should have been, in any other thing, should have been reprimanded. But the throwing the punch is just it's just beyond the pale. I mean, that was just – and people say, well, it's a slap. Yeah, you slap someone like that, your thumb goes into someone's eye. You could poke a freaking eye out, you know. So, But Guard's nobody, like I said. But I don't know.
Yeah.
I thought it was a shame. The Hurley thing, I thought it was just I don't mean to digress to that.
No, go ahead.
Go
ahead. I want your thoughts on that because I'm mystified by it. I still don't get what he did that was so wrong.
I can't say anything about it other than what you said. Because there is, to my knowledge, there is nothing wrong with the second one. The way I assessed it from reading and stuff is the whistle was blown from the other side of the court. He did absolutely nothing. In fact, I could argue, and I get refs have to take control, but I could argue the first technical was kind of BS. I mean, Bobby Knight would do that stuff all the time.
Yeah.
But he was mystified, too. Hurley was mystified, too, by it, and there's no other term to describe it. It was weird. And then at the end of the game, there was a bunch of weird calls. Now, I personally thought that last play, I thought it was a charge. I can understand the Villanova people saying it wasn't a charge.
That's just an arguable call. That's always
right,
a call.
Right,
that's
just a judgment call. Right. But the thing, I was looking at it, and I'm like, I just think it was a brain fart by the ref. He thought maybe he was being slighted for the first technical. Maybe it was the same ref. And he's like, oh, really?
Yeah.
In other words, let's get down on the ref. He misinterpreted it, I think.
Yeah.
And there's going to be some things going on with the refs, too. I mean, you're going to hear an apology or at least, hey, I messed that one up in the next couple of days. Hey, I made a bad call. I thought it was something that it wasn't. I realized after I blew the whistle. But whenever they blow a whistle, they're not going to recant. So yeah, I think that's going to be a nothing burger. But, yeah, I've never seen – I couldn't believe it. I'm looking at, like, five different reels this morning, and I'm like, this makes no sense.
Yeah, I mean, they had to zero in. They had, I think they had to change, like, video focus to even show what it was that got the first technical, you know. So that, I don't –
Yeah,
kinda,
and I think, like I said, if anything, I thought the first technical – maybe shouldn't have been called. So no,
right,
it was just,
exactly,
to me, it was just a freak thing we're not going to see again for another 20 years. It was just freakish. Yeah. I mean, when I'm looking at this, I'm like, this makes no sense.
So did you see Howard's statement, his later statement that he said?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he said, after taking the time to reflect, I realized how unacceptable and blah, blah, blah. And he says, lastly, I speak a lot about being a Michigan man and representing the University of Michigan with class and pride. I did not do that, nor did I set the right example in the right way for my student athletes. I will learn from my mistake, and this will never happen again. No excuses. So what did he say after he went after Mark Turgeon last year?
Well, and this is my thing. We're all human. We all F up. But about 24 hours before that statement, he made a statement of, no, I've got nothing to apologize for. So what does that translate to? Okay, he's got his back against the wall. President, athletic, whoever is saying, listen, you got to save this school some face. I don't care if you have to fake it. Fake it. Because it was not in his heart. I'm sorry. You don't do a 180 unless you got your back against the wall. Oh, I'm going to lose my coaching job? Okay, I'll dance. I'll do whatever the hell you need me to do. I don't want to lose my coaching job. I don't think it was sincere. He's had other issues where supposedly he's told other coaches and stuff, yeah, I'm going to fuck you up, you know, that sort of thing. So, no, to me, he's a thug. But
yeah,
you take a team in your first, second year, you take them to the Elite Eight. You know, there's a lot of forgiveness for success in sports now. And so, you know, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he will change, but I'll believe it when I see it.
Here's what I don't understand. Okay. Bob, you mentioned him still getting to coach the Big Ten tournament. Effectively, he's getting, I mean, now I don't know, he's going to have some, you know, forfeit some pay other than the $40,000 fine that's between him and Michigan. But what I don't get, I mean, as you said, everybody plays in the Big Ten tournament. And not only that, even though they wouldn't be projected to, he could get him into the NCAA. So what really, there's really no penalty. And 40 grand, I mean, he was probably making that when he was playing at Michigan, you know, with the Fab Five. I mean, that's just
a
joke. So,
yeah, 40 grand's nothing. Supposedly he's worth $80 million. Do the math. It's like I said, it's 50 cents on $1,000. It's nothing.
Do you ever remember in a game in which you were involved any coach acting like that? Ever?
When I was a freshman, we have a coach. You know his name. Nickname was Bucky. He got a little riled. And as you know, somewhat of a diminutive guy. He's about 5'3", 98 pounds soaking wet. And he, I forget the exact circumstances, but yeah, he went after another coach.
Is that when he said, get out of my face? Was that the time when he said, get out of my face?
I think that's it. Yeah, yeah. He said, did it to a ref, right? Get out of my face.
Yeah, get out of my face.
Yeah, there was, I'm being hyperbolic. There was no fist thrown or anything, but there was fingers pointed and stuff. But no, beyond that, that's the first time I've ever seen it. Now, if we go cross sports, obviously we all remember Woody Hayes.
Yeah.
But he hit a guy that had a helmet on. All he did was hurt his own wrist or whatever the hell it was.
Well, he went after a player. I mean, I think that is definitely crossing the line and all that stuff. I just don't get, you know, $40,000. What really does that? I mean, that's just such a joke.
It's
What message is being sent? Now, here's the question. Here's the other question. Do you think Michigan will do anything? Do you think they will go after him in any way, like anger management or whatever, like T. Bodie said in the chat, in the group chat?
If they do, it'll be nothing but window dressing. It'll be like, listen, you know, we're Michigan. We got a reputation. Just go to it. Wink, wink. Send a surrogate. Wink, wink. Do whatever you got to do. But we got to do a press release. So, yeah, there might be something like that. But, no, I do not believe Michigan will. I don't think they're I put it this way. They're such a, quote, high-esteemed public university. I don't buy into that with Michigan, and maybe I'm too cynical or whatever, but I've seen Harbaugh do things. Obviously this, I saw what they did to Lloyd Carr. No, I don't think they're going to do shit. Or if they do, like I said, it's going to be colored bubbles. It's going to be something that looks really cute and stuff, but there's not going to be any more ramifications.
Yeah.
Because I bet you he said to them, listen, I did your fucking this is what I bet you he said. Listen, I did your fucking apology. Shit or get off the pot. You want to fire me? You deal with all the boosters. You deal with everyone else. I did your fucking bidding. I danced for you. And this is what he would be saying because he is a thug. I danced for you. It's against my nature. I ain't doing shit again. If you want to say anger management, fine. Send me there. I won't be showing up, but you can tell whoever you want to tell that I'm going to do anger management. That's just my cynical belief on him. I think he's a thug.
Yeah, and I'm afraid you're right, unfortunately. But so okay, now back to the ponies. So the Medina Spirit disqualification a year and a half, or not quite a year later. What's the point? Why did they do it?
The point is, don't think of it from a bettor's perspective. Think of it from a owner, trainer.
Okay.
Perspective. In other words, we've got to do something that's going to make it so these people get off the drugs. Now, get their horses off the drugs. Now, there again, that's followed by a wink, wink. You know, it's like, hey, guys, just don't get caught. That's the whole thing in horse racing. What they do is now the 1.3 or whatever Medina Spirit one goes to the second place horse. I don't remember his name.
Mandolin.
He's now officially up there. And now owners are going to be a little bit leery with shady trainers. But here's the deal. It's like baseball, like I've said before, during the era of steroids, they were all doing it. The question is, who's getting caught? Who's getting caught? And Baffert got caught. Todd Fletcher, very, very notable trainer.
Yeah.
He's caught a million times back when he was doing the Delaware circuit. They all, for the most part, they all do it. Hell, they're called milkshakes. I think I said this last year on this. They're called milkshakes. What they do is they find out what drugs are going to be tested for. The veterinarians make a masking agent, for lack of a better term, that makes it so those drugs don't pop up. Sometimes they do, and you're fucked.
Yeah.
You get busted.
Yeah.
Now, his argument is, and the reason he's appealing it, the chemical that was in his body, they say he injected it. He said bullshit. It was a cream that was put on the horse's legs for tenderness, which happens all the time. And he says that's his argument. I don't buy it for a second, but that's his argument.
Okay. So
that's why he's appealing it. I'm innocent.
Okay. Okay. So you said the bettors, don't think of it from a bettors perspective. Now, what about bettors that has bet on on Mandaloon? Do they have
nothing,
a gripe? Or,
nothing. They get nothing.
Okay. So
that's done.
So that's
in all
from a
horse
betting perspective,
track,
it's
all,
done.
All horse tracks, here's what you do. This is why you never tear up a ticket until you see one thing on the board, and that is official. The minute it becomes official, it's official for the better. In other words, when one horse goes down and no horse is brought up, sorry guys, that's the nature of the beast. Just like pass interference in the Ohio State Miami game, I had $100,000 on that game. Sorry, might have been a bad call, but that's the way it is, and that's how it is for the better. So the better is not going to get a dollar back. And think about it, that's a practical impossibility. All right, all of you guys that bet this horse, we would like you to return the money so we can pay it to the ones that are second. Oh, okay. I'll be right down there tomorrow.
I got it. So now on the Baffert suspension, does it really even – I mean, 90 days, when does that start? I assume that starts like now, or does that start
– Yeah, February 15. He is not going to be eligible for the Derby because the Derby is what, the second Saturday of
Saturday of May. First Saturday.
It is the first Saturday. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That was the second. Okay. Yeah. So by, just do the arithmetic, March, April, May, the thing was instilled, I think, on the 15th. So the first Saturday in May is not going to be by May 15th.
Right.
So no, he's not going to be eligible. And I think you mentioned it. I think a lot of the other tracks are going to follow suit. Because remember, this is only Kentucky, but the other tracks have said they're going to follow suit. you said California, to my surprise, was going to honor Kentucky's ruling. That kind of shocks me because I know he's big out in California. But they very well might. But no, he's not going to be – I mean, the prep races, well, now it's a moot point. You know, he's already been – I think you mentioned it. He's already been in a few prep races. You know, and
so what happens going forward? I mean, like, do you think he's going to have owners that shy away from him now?
I don't know the mindset of the billionaire that's got fifth generation money, and that's basically who they are. Steinbrenner used to own horses. I don't know if the family still does, but old Kentucky. I mean, we're talking Civil War like money. What do people want to do? What do you want to do in sports? You want to win.
Yeah.
So the question is, do we roll the dice on this guy? He's paid his price. He's suspended for 90 days. Will he cheat again? Oh, incidentally, don't think for a minute the owners didn't know that he cheated. And let me also say this, so people know this. That's the first time he got caught cheating.
Yeah.
You got to understand that. Probably minimal of 150 races. Because when you're not doing the Triple Crown, well, he's probably got a horse entered probably 12 different tracks three times a day. I mean, he's probably got 30 horses entered a day. You know, people are like, well, it's just a derby. No, he's got horses in California. He's got horses in Kentucky. He's the CEO of a corporation that's got vice presidents that are training in Delaware. He can't be in Delaware and Santa Anita across the country at the same time. So I think owners, I think, you know, just like anything else, a basketball player gets suspended for 3 months because of drugs. Do they take him back on? Sure they do, because they want to win, and he's a good basketball player. Well, Bob Baffert, say what you want. He gets results, you know. I mean, I won't even go, leave it for the ethicist to decide right or wrong, but he gets results. He's considered probably one of the three best trainers out there, at least dirt trainer.
So how do bettors will bettors react to this, or are we just talking hardcore bettors and addicts who don't give a crap? They're just there to bet anyway.
Bettors couldn't give two shits. What bettors do is – it's actually been a transformation. 40s, 30s, 40s, people bet on horses. 50s, 60s, they're like, oh, wait a second, this jockey's got a hand in it. So I'm talking about the real gamblers that do their homework.
Yeah.
70s and 80s, they went from jockey to trainer. Oh, my God. Wait a second. These trainers are really what really makes the horse run. And then I literally heard, I haven't gambled horses for years, but I literally heard when I was leaving, the new thing was, believe it or not, the great handicappers would get the public information, find out who the veterinarians are. And I'm not kidding. They literally got to the point where they're studying the veterinarian success rates without being busted. So no, the gambler, whether it be the degenerate gambler or the professional gambler or Aunt Mary going there for a mint julep and a bet or two, they don't give a fuck. They don't give a fuck because it's all paramutual. And, you know, you're not going to ride Bob Baffert in the long run and make money because he's going to be overbet.
Okay.
So, you know, if anything, the real gambler is pissed off knowing that Baffert's going to be overbet. Now he's going to have more fair odds. And a real gambler doesn't want fair odds. He wants to get what's called value. And Baffert brings it so you can get value from another horse because he's over bet. So if anything, they're upset by the fact that they can't bet the other horses with the same value they would get if Baffert was still around. But no, it doesn't make a lick of difference.
Okay.
From a better standpoint.
Does he, while he's appealing this, is he still working or not? Is he shut down even though he's appealing?
No, I don't think he's shut down. Like I said, he's still has been doing prep races. He's shut down, to my knowledge, in Kentucky. Now, can he race horses while he's appealing? To be honest with you, I don't know that. But I know for a fact he is not eligible for the Derby.
Okay.
But I don't know if he can run in what would be out right now this time of year. It'd probably be Santa Anita. in California. It would be Aqueduct. I don't know if he's in New York. I don't know if during the appeal
process.
Remember,
he was already suspended in New York last year. Remember, he didn't run the Belmont, and he was suspended. Right.
Yeah. I don't know how long that carried over, though. I don't know. Yeah. That was just, all right, go Pimlico, Laurel, Maryland. I mean, do any circuit. New Orleans, the fairgrounds. I don't know particular circuits. I don't even know his stomping grounds. I actually want to say he grew up on the Kentucky circuit, but I could be wrong there. But I thought he was predominantly Midwest, but if there's any horse people out there, don't hold me to that. He might have been, he might have been Arlington, Hawthorne, Kentucky.
Yeah.
Okay. And then when they hit major status, that's when they are across the whole country.
Right. So is it too early for bettors to start looking at potential Derby bets, or is it too far out? We don't know the full. We don't know enough of the field.
I would imagine Vegas has futures. I came across a story the other day, and I want to say it was the horse that won the Breeders' Cup Futurity, which is 2-year-olds, obviously, last year, that he might be the favorite, but I might be confusing him with a horse that got injured. But I thought I read something here. Again, I could be wrong, that they're looking at the favorite to be right now 8-1. And you're going to have futures. You can go to Vegas and do futures, but kind of silly because if a horse gets injured, you're out of your money.
But
these prep races, the big ones down here in Florida, Gulfstream's got a couple of them. Santa Anita Derby out in California, Wood Memorial up there in New York at Aqueduct, Bluegrass Stakes. There's, I think, a total of 35 prep races that you have to – you don't have to go to all of them, obviously, but that's how you get garnish points to see if you can even run in the Derby type of thing.
Okay, okay.
So it's just so early now. It's like betting on this – no, it's way too early.
Yeah. So
but
Baffert
you could.
Has
theoretically, you can.
Okay. So Baffert has the last two Triple Crowns. Do you think it's going to happen in our lifetime with someone else, or is that just – is it his ability and his magic touch, or do you think he's just cheated better, or – do you think we'll see another Triple Crown from a different trainer?
Well, how long did we go without a Triple Crown? What, 80 to 2016?
Yeah, 77 or 78 until 2015.
I think it was Spectacular Bid. I could be wrong. I am not a good horse historian when it comes to dates and names and stuff. But, yeah, I mean, just do the math. If you're going 30 years without even having a – yeah, without even having won, the fact that Baffert pulled it off twice is pretty remarkable. So just going by statistically speaking, can there be another Wayne Gretzky, Michael Jordan? Yeah, I guess it's theoretically possible, but I certainly would say if you're going to play odds, we're talking about a thing that's related to odds, I would say it's not going to happen in our lifetimes. But there's some good trainers out there. There's some good trainers.
So is anyone ever going to beat Secretariat's Triple Crown times, at least in our lifetime?
No. Secretariat is the – I obviously can't speak to Man of War. Secretariat is Jordan, Babe Ruth, Tom Brady combined. That's how good he is. He ran – this is only for the horse guys out there. He ran 23 quarter-mile fractions the whole mile and a half of the Belmont Stakes. He owns that record to this day. I think that's, 73, thereabouts?
Yeah, yeah. So you're looking at 50 years.
Day.
Yeah.
When they did the autopsy on him, he's like, he fucking had an enlarged heart, but not in the bad sense. His heart could just metabolize, or whatever you call it, oxygen and carbon dioxide at just this uncanny level. To do a 23 quarter on the last quarter of a 1.5 mile race, that's Belmont. The other one's 1.25 and 1.3/16, the other two. It can't be done. Horses can barely do it in a 6-furlong race. Now, that's an exaggeration, but that's only 3/4 of a mile. They can barely do it. It would be like a sprinter, Usain Bolt, keeping that speed for a quarter of a mile, as you
or,
know,
or for
a
half mile.
It can't be done. It's a physiological impossibility. Well, Secretariat did several things that were physiological impossibilities. Another thing Secretariat did, he wasn't known for it, but he went over to the turf. And running on dirt and running on turf are absolutely two different things. You can have a horse that is, generally speaking, a great, great turf runner is not going to be necessarily good on dirt and vice versa. Secretariat did it all. It's amazing. I think he ended up with four losses. I know he lost to Onion when he was a two-year-old, but no, the horse was just incredible. You remember a horse called Arazi. They thought he was going to be the next Secretariat. And then, because he won the Breeders' Cup Futures by a shit ton, and the jockey got, I don't know if it was McCarron, but whoever it was, got so damn cocky, he says, I don't care what lane we're in, I can just go to the outside of the course and still win this race. And then he shit the bed on the Derby.
Yep.
But no, to answer your question, to answer your question, no, Secretariat will never be. But then again, now, it's kind of like baseball and stuff. It can't be duplicated. Now horses are going out faster. They've got better a horse needs to be tested. Ruffian, everyone says, the best female runner ever was. They did a match race with, I think it was the Derby winner.
Yeah,
and Ruffian comes around the – Ruffian comes around the corner and blows his leg. And everyone's like, well, I don't get it. Wow, he's never been hurt before. Well, I certainly get it. He is running at a pace he's not comfortable with. He's a front runner, and he wants to be out in front. So he's doing that which his body cannot endure, hence the broken leg. There's only been three fillies that have won in, 148 years, however long it's gone on for the Kentucky Derby. So, I mean, it's next to an impossibility. And now you've got people that have dual entries. In other words, Baffert will have his best horse as a closer, one that comes from behind. He's got another horse in there that's a rabbit. He'll just put it in there to make the horse go out fast. The other horses, because they're herd animals, will go out with him. They'll all burn out, and then, boom, Baffert's other horse, the one he wanted to win, wins. So there's so much of that going on now. But Secretariat's probably that horse that could come in today's game and just piss on these horses.
Yeah,
we're not talking about Michael Jordan. Yeah, we're talking Michael Jordan on steroids.
Yeah, the last two Triple Crown winners have not approached any of his times. You know, I mean, it was just
No. And, you know, the thing they talk about the Belmont Stakes is 30-length victory. And I've heard horse historians that know more about it than me. They're like, bullshit, it was more than 30 lengths. I mean, it was just gross. You know,
it was huge.
But no, horse was nothing but the truth.
Yeah. Here's the last item. You know how dog racing has been attacked, social justice warriors and all that. You think it's going to happen in horse racing, or do you think horse racing is sacrosanct because there's so much wealth in it? I mean, you know, you really don't hear of like aristocrats in the dog racing world the way you do in the horse racing world. Do you think horse racing's ever going to be? You think so?
No. I said, in the sense that you're absolutely right. You can go. You've seen them. We've been to the track. You've seen these owners of dogs and stuff. Let's put it this way. Chaucer's not on their reading list. You know, Macbeth, they would say Mick who, you know, but you try to fuck with the, you try to fuck with Phillips or Steinbrenner or those people. They're like, get the fuck out of here. Now, one thing they were projecting that I haven't followed it much lately, but because of all of the off-track betting stuff, they thought things were going to consolidate. Instead of having 50 tracks throughout the country, 100 tracks, whatever it is, they thought by now it was going to be down to maybe 12, 15 tracks. But the way they stay alive now, a lot of it is they'll just do the casino, the slot machines and stuff inside the horse track, and that'll be their that'll be what pays the bills, so to speak. But I always thought, and I prophesized – yeah, and I prophesized it wrong. I thought there was still always going to be horse racing, which there always will be horse racing. I just thought it was going to be on a grander scale with less tracks. In other words, Santa Anita, Belmont, Aqueduct, Keeneland, obviously Churchill Downs, Saratoga, and then maybe 12, 15 more that are geographically located where Gulfstream, South Florida, you know, you got the retirees and all of that. But horse racing isn't going away, because I'll tell you what, you can bring on PETA and whatever. And one of those boys, they don't fuck around, those big shots. You know that. They don't fuck around. They're going to be like, all right, what the fuck do you want? You want $3 million? All right, here's the non-disclosure. Here's your fucking $3 million. If I see you around the track again, you're going to have your fucking car blown up, you bitch. Yeah, I mean, I'm just telling it like it is. You know the routine.
I know what you're saying. I mean, no. it's
hey, these billionaires don't get there by playing by the rules, you know?
Well, I mean, tax base, too. You know, tax base, how important is Churchill Downs to the state of Kentucky, or at least to that area of the Kentucky? It's huge. You take away a dog track. You take away a dog track in Miami, nobody knows. You know, you take away a dog track in Chicago, I don't think ever had it. But, you know, but you take away you take Belmont out of New York, it kills it.
I mean, the people who do this, I'm actually not going to put them that much. I'll put them a level ahead of Antifa and stuff. But what they are is they're bullies. They need something to, quote, it's their religion. They need something to stand for. And think about it, dog racing. Now, the fact that they got out of Florida, I will say, is pretty impressive. But in the sense that Florida, you know, they were pretty big into dog racing. Put it this way, they've hit their Peter principle. they ain't going. They're never going to get in the league of the horses, I can assure you. They'll try.
Yeah.
You'll have little bits and pieces, and then they'll go away. Translation, someone gave them $1 million and said, shut the fuck up, go smoke your weed, do whatever the fuck it is you want to do. Just stay the fuck away from us. And they will stay away. And they'll say, that this is your warning. Here's your $1 million. This is your warning. Otherwise... Yeah. Doggone it, it's so amazing how you got a Toyota Camry. Gosh darn it, it's amazing how those things just blow up, isn't it? What are you talking about? Oh, I didn't mean anything. And then the dummy would take about 12 hours to figure it out. Oh, he's going to blow up my car if I come back for more, you know? So,
yeah.
No, horse racing ain't going anywhere.
Okay. Hey, we're going to take a break because it's I've got to bring Mike on in a bit. But I'm going to give you a special treat during this break. We're going to play the entirety of your song.
Wow, fantastic idea. Listen, I'm good to go.
No, you can stay on if you want, but I'm just going to put you on mute so that you can listen to your song.
Okay.
Like, I wouldn't deprive you of
your song.
All right,
I look forward to it.
Thanks for Brother Tommy for being here. I also want to thank others that are listening in. Mike, thanks for being patient. Big Sister's listening. Sue's on the phone. We got Indy Hawk and T. Bodie and Annie, Southern Sense Radio, in the chat room. So, folks, this is a good time to get in if you want. Meantime, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to give Brother Tommy his full theme music as he deserves, and then we will be back with Hawk. Guy Mike. Take it easy for a couple of minutes.
This is TJ, dedicating the song to Let Belly.
Whoa, Black Betty, Bamba Lamb. Whoa, Black Betty, Bamba Lamb. She's from Birmingham. Bamba Lamb, way down in Alabama. Bamba Lamb, the way she shake that thing. Bamba Lamb, boy, she make me sing. Bamba Lamb, whoa, Black Betty. Yeah. She really getting me high. Bamba Lamb, you know that's no lie. Bamba Lamb, she's so rock steady. Bamba Lamb, but she's always ready. Bamba Lamb, whoa, Black Betty. 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 Bamba Lamb. where she posted my bed. Friday we went walking. Saturday I was out of my door. On Sunday we was talking. Back on Monday she pawned all my clothes. Oh, Black Betty, Bamba Lamba. Oh, Black Betty, Bamba Lamba. She from Birmingham, Bamba Lamba. Way down in Alabama, Bamba Lamba. The way she shake that thing, Bamba Lamba. Oh, she make me sing, Bamba Lamba. Oh, Black Betty, Bamba Lamba. Oh, Black Betty, Bamba Lamba. She really get me high. Bamba Lamba, you know that's no lie. Bamba Lamba, she's so rock steady. Bamba Lamba, she's always ready. Bamba Lamba, oh, Black Betty. 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 Bamba Lamba.
As I said, TJ, Tom Jones version of Black Betty for Brother Tommy. Thanks again for being on. Some good stuff on both basketball and horse racing, as those two things made some sports news. Coming up, Hawkeye Mike's coming in a second. Just want to quickly bring up what's going to sort of be talking about. Russia on the brink of invading Ukraine, if you want to call it that, if they haven't already. Dopey Joe and La Dopey Nostra are supposedly negotiating. On PMSNBC, it's called Maddow Blog. I don't think she's doing it. They say Putin didn't invade Ukraine under Donald J. Trump because, and wait for it, they said Putin was so pleased to see Trump pursuing goals in line with Russia's agenda. They actually wrote that and put it on a blog. I'm not even going to, you know. Anyway, Hawkeye Mike's coming in, but I promised at one point I'd get him an intro song. And so here we go. He's going to like this because this is a version he's not used to hearing probably.
Alone, I took a ride, I didn't know what I would find there. Another road where maybe I could find another kind of mind there. Ooh, then I suddenly see you. Ooh, did I tell you I need you every single day of my life? You didn't run, you didn't hide, you knew I wanted just to hold you. And had you gone, you knew in time we'd meet again, or I'd have told you. Ooh, you were meant to be near me, ooh, and I want you to hear me say we'll be together every day. Gotta get you into my life.
Okay, I had to play it. Mike, you there?
I'm there, Hank. I like it.
So who, do you know who was doing that?
No, you know, I've been racking my brain trying to figure out who that was. You have to tell me.
You're not going to believe it. Joe Pesci.
From, I never would have guessed that.
I'm not kidding. I believe the album was called Hey, This Kid Can Sing. Literally, Hey, This Kid Can Sing. So, yeah, we don't do the originals on here.
Joe Piscopo's got nothing on Joe Pesci.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a real version. I mean, it wasn't a joke. It wasn't yeah, I just thought that was kind of
like. Does William Shatner have a version of this?
I don't think so.
Got to get you into my life.
Got to get you into my life. No, it's Pesci's the only one that does that song justice.
Fuck,
I mean, I liked Earth, Wind & Fire's version, but yeah, Joe Pesci, that's the standard now. I mean, other than the Beatles, of course.
Yeah.
Okay, so bring us up a recent timeline of events. I mean, not like the last 10 years, but sort of bring everyone up to speed on what's happened in the what's transpired the last couple of years and how we've gotten to where we are now.
You're talking about like with Russia
in
Ukraine and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, you know, actually, you go back to a few years more than that. If you remember back in 2014, Russia just decided that they were going to annex the Crimea, which was a part of the sovereign territory of the Ukraine. And basically, Obama didn't do anything, or there was really a pretty mild reaction. Now, let me preface all this by saying I am in no way supporting or supportive of the U.S. engaging in any kind of direct military conflict with Russia over anything to do with the Ukraine.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that we, you know, that cherish and the right of people to self-determination and the sovereignty of countries should not be alarmed by what's going on and what Putin has shown a propensity to do for the last 7-8 years. There was also just a few years before that, if you recall, basically he invaded Georgia and took a chunk of territory. But in the Ukraine in particular, he took Crimea in 2014, basically annexed it. And, you know, what we're seeing is a continuation of that now, I think. In fact, I think it's a broader continuation of a desire to basically reconstitute the old Soviet Empire,
okay.
All the states, you know, and we can get into that a little later, but that could really have some ramifications beyond just the Ukraine.
Yeah. So how soon should we expect the full-on invasion?
Well, you know, it seems like for about the last week or two, they've been talking about, you know, the invasion's imminent. It's going to happen on Tuesday. It's going to happen on, you know, Thursday at 3 p.m. So you got to take that a little bit with a grain of salt. But I have been seeing things on the news today that makes me think that it's probably going to happen in the next day or two. And when I say it's going to happen, I'm talking about like a major invasion by Russian forces into Ukraine. And the reason I say that is based on a couple things. I saw a couple generals that I respect, David Petraeus and Jack Keane, who were on and who hadn't been saying these things before, but now are saying when they look at the configuration of Russian forces and also you also see combined with a uptick in the rhetoric coming out of Russia and some other things such as the bringing in of field hospitals right close to troops that are on the border along with large supplies of whole blood. You're not doing this if you're not going to do something. And
yeah.
So they both think that it's going to happen within 48 hours. And that seems to be the consensus with the unnamed sources in the U.S. government as well. You know, I thought when they went into the eastern Ukraine, just a couple provinces called Luhansk and the Donetsk regions, the whole area is kind of called the Donbass. That might be all that they were going to do, and in hoping that, you know, is, you know, and I'm not condoning that, but you know, I didn't think maybe they were at least for a long time going to consider anything more. Looks like they want all of the Ukraine. So
okay, so how resistant and resilient and most important, how equipped is Ukraine to deal with this?
Well, that's a good question. That's a very good question. They have an army of a couple hundred thousand men, and they have been armed by the West in the last several years, but they don't have the arsenal or the forces to take on Russia. Now, they will. And by the way, that another key telltale sign here is there's been basically a general call-up of reservists by the Ukrainians.
Okay.
But they will fight. And they can't – I don't think they can win. I think the Russians will probably be able to overwhelm them in short order. They've just got superior force and superior forces. But the Ukrainians are not just going to roll over, I don't think. And I'm not saying this because I have any special insight. Again, listening to both Petraeus and Keane and some others, they are pretty convinced that the Ukrainians will fight. So there will be a lot of blood if this happens, I think Putin could end up regretting doing this on a whole lot of levels, but yeah. I think it's going to happen.
So is anyone going to step in to help? I mean, when you mentioned the U.S., NATO, I know they're not a NATO member, but they are a NATO, they're sort of affiliated. Will the U.S. or NATO or will it get to – will the U.N. step in to help?
No, I don't think that any there's going to be any direct military intervention by an outside power. And I wouldn't – I don't support the sending U.S. troops into a direct confrontation with Russian troops over the Ukraine, as bad as I say what's going on is. But I don't think the American people would support that, and I don't think that it's worth starting what could be World War III. But there is, you know, there are implications from this that we do have to consider that go beyond the Ukraine that affect the United States and NATO. And I think that Putin has designs beyond just the Ukraine. And then the other factor, of course, is China's watching very closely. And,
yeah,
you know, I think that any sort of lack of resolution by the West will embolden them against Taiwan.
Yeah. So you
we live in a dangerous world, Hank.
Yeah. Oh, no. I mean, I was going to say, what a success.
You know, it's easy to forget this as you go about your daily life. And you know, it didn't have, and you know, we haven't seen any, you know, if this kind of a war breaks out that I think is going to break out, it's going to be the biggest thing since the end of World War II in Europe.
Yeah. So do you think this emboldens Russia? I mean, especially if nobody steps in, do you think that emboldens them to move further outward? I'm thinking like Poland and the Baltic states.
Well, I think that's the big question, because I think the Baltic states were a part of the Soviet Empire. They were,
right.
They were, you know, part of that whole. And I think he has designs on the Baltic states. And the question becomes, this is going to be the big question. The Baltic states are a different kettle of fish because they are now NATO members.
Yes.
If any kind of act of aggression toward any of those countries, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia,
right,
would theoretically trigger Article 5 of the NATO treaty, which is the attack on one is an attack on all. It would be war with NATO. Now, the question then becomes, and this is why if we do basically don't do much in the Ukraine, will he be emboldened and maybe to assume, maybe miscalculate even, that we would not be willing to basically start World War III over the Baltic states? He may calculate that we won't. He may be right with our current president.
Yeah.
And that's what happens when aggression starts and little is done. You can go back to the Hitler analogy. It's not necessarily a perfect analogy, but if you recall with the what was called the Anschluss, basically the occupation and takeover of Austria, followed shortly thereafter by the Sudetenland, peace in our time, right, Chamberlain, that gave a big chunk of that country to Germany. And, you know, of course, this was just, you know, going taking back what was belonged to Germany, Austria and the Sudetenland, which was filled with ethnic Germans. Of course, within a couple months, he had all of Czechoslovakia. And the weakness of the Allies at that time led him to miscalculate and believe he could do the same with Poland, especially after they cut the non-aggression pact with Stalin. He that France and the United Kingdom, Great Britain, would not react and would not go to war over his taking over of Poland, which turned out to be a big miscalculation, and they did, and World War II started. So it's miscalculations and sort of the add-on effect or the domino effect of aggression that's, you know, from a dictator that's not stood up to, that can lead that and then weakness displayed against that leads to that can lead to war on a larger scale. Yeah. So that's the thing that we should really be concerned about and nervous about.
Okay, so
what
will this do to the U.S. economy just in the short term? What does Putin going into Ukraine? What does it do to the U.S. economy, in your opinion? Do you think it has much of an effect or no?
You know, again, it's hard to prognosticate, but I do think that, and that's another key thing here that will directly affect us. And then there's the issue of whether cyber attacks might be
executed against the United States and our allies if Putin doesn't like how we react to a full-scale invasion of the Ukraine. But what will happen, and it's already started to happen, is a spike in oil prices because our current administration, in its infinite wisdom, as you know, has basically taken the United States from being self-sufficient energy-wise to being a net importer again. And this has happened through the shutdown of key pipelines, including the Keystone Pipeline, and then also the basically deciding they're not going to allow any increased production, you know, not allow
right. Yeah, pulling
leasing.
Back oil leases,
well,
basically pulling back
it's
oil
basically,
leases, yeah.
It's so insane. It's all done in the name of you know, climate change, which, remember, the biggest crisis the world faces is climate change. I think you're about to find out that's, in the worst way, you know, how stupid that belief is. Because what's going to happen is I think that's going to spike oil prices. And if you get gas up to, you know, $5 a gallon, we already have a problem. It's been the main fueler of inflation in this country, which is really – you know, gotten real bad, and it's all because of the, and it's not because of the Ukraine per se. It's because of the policies. If we had maintained our energy independence, what happens in the Ukraine energy wise wouldn't affect us. We could also go to our allies in Germany and Europe, and say, you don't need the Nord Stream 2. We can supply all your oil, but because radical environmentalists that run the Democratic Party believe that fossil fuels are the root of all evil production, we've increased price, you know, and this affects everything, right? Fuel price, because it affects transportation of goods. And so there you go. It all spirals out. And so the short-sighted policies of this current administration has made what's going on in the Ukraine matter to us more, because it's going to spike oil prices.
Yeah. You think
more than they already have spiked.
Yeah. Do you think Dopey Nostra, I hate to say, do you think Biden will do it? Because I don't even want to give – I don't think he's running anything. I literally, as you've heard me say, I literally think he's jello right now all across the board. But do you think the powers that be in, you know, La Dopey Nostra, you think they're going to go like FDR on us and try and make this a war, you know, maybe invite aggression and make it a war economy, thinking that a war economy will help us recover? You think that danger is real?
I don't know. I mean, I think that the reaction from the administration is going to be one of weakness. It's not going to, you know, these initial sanctions supposedly that Biden announced the other day, they're pathetic. There are sanctions, and there are things we could do that could really affect Russia, but I'm not holding my breath that that's going to happen. And I'm talking about things that basically really go after their oil production. We could announce that we're, you know, in light of what's going on, we're going to increase our own domestic production. We're not going to shut down the Keystone Pipeline. Do you think that's going to happen? I don't.
No.
But, you know, as far as like the wartime economy, you know, I don't know that there's, you're going to see a Biden do really much of anything other than, you know, blow a lot of smoke about what's going on.
Well, here's what scares me about all this, okay? It makes you wonder, pulling back of oil production, et cetera. I mean, is this really about climate change, or is it about handing power over to others? I mean, in effect, that's what they did. They handed power to OPEC. They handed power to, you know, to other countries who, you know, either by making them providers – you know, I mean, I don't even know the motivation. I mean, I'd love to sit there and say, yeah, these enviro wackos wanted us to pull back production of oil because they would. I don't know if that's it. That's what's scary to me. I'm not sure that that's really
well,
it. When you hear about deals that they make with Russia and China and stuff, that's what scares me.
Well, I mean, yeah, no, that's a good point. And that's right. You remember what Rush Limbaugh said, basically what it was about was central control, the environmental, you know, extremists. That they were socialists, and I believe that's true, and I think that's the fuel behind this new Green Deal stuff. It's basically socialism and state control of things, and I mean, we're not ready to switch over to wind turbines and atomic power to provide us all of our power, although I'm, you know, fine with all those things, but we're a long way from being there. And so the question is, are we going to have our own production and not be dependent on what goes on in the rest of the world? Or are we just going to be basically importing it like we are now? Because there is a constant level of oil and natural gas that we need and will need for a while. The question is, are we going to produce it here or are we going to import it? For some reason, they think that these people think that having us do our own production of these things is immoral or a threat to the world to global warming or something, when it just means that other countries are going to be doing it, and they're probably going to be less clean about how they produce oil and gas than we are in this country. So it's a total absurdity.
Yeah. Well, how about, okay, talking about, the Keystone Pipeline, which involves Canada, we've seen what happened with the Canadian truckers. If our own convoy fires up and what they're supposed to in March and head to Washington, you think we have that level of oppression here? You think La Dope Nostra will do here what Trudeau has done in Canada?
I think they would like to, but I think that there's this little thing called the U.S. Constitution that would hinder them from doing, anything. Trudeau invoked martial law under that Emergencies Act, and they started seizing people's bank. If you gave $50, if all you did was give $50, because we've heard these stories, to this outfit, to this organization that was these truckers that went to Ottawa.
Right.
You were liable and in many cases had your bank accounts frozen. That kind of thing could never happen in this country. And that's pretty scary stuff. I mean,
totalitarian stuff. You don't think they would try it here?
And you always think of Canada as being such a benign country, right? Cheap laughs and Don Mills and all that kind of stuff. But, this stuff is, our mutual friend of ours, who I think is probably pretty alarmed about what's going on up there.
Well, Derek Hunter wrote a piece on Town Hall called, it says it's Canada shows why it's called American exceptionalism. And he talked about that. He said it's not just about the Second Amendment. He says, you have to remember, we have a tendency to think that, Australia, Canada, Great Britain, et cetera, are all exactly like us. He says, but their freedom is still different than ours. He says the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms grants Canadians various rights that, if you don't think about it, are similar in a lot of ways to the rights we enjoy here, but there's a major difference. Our Constitution grants exactly zero rights to anyone. It acknowledges the rights that are already there, that we are born with, and it denies the federal government the ability to infringe. The Canadian Charter, it gives citizens rights, and as he said, they are just used to that. He says, for everybody, if they did what they did, if they tried it here, he says, no, because he says, not just conservatives, Americans in general have never lived like that, have never lived under the idea that government always has the right to go in and do stuff versus, he says, Canada, the UK, whatever. So that's, I don't know. Do you really think that, I think too many Americans don't feel that way.
I think people do assume, I think people do assume that Canada and Australia, Great Britain, they all basically operate like we do. They don't have the Constitution that we have, and they don't have the kind of check on central governmental power that we have in this country. I'll give you an example of something that just recently happened, and you'll recall this, was the Biden administration attempted to impose vaccine mandates and mask mandates, I think, but primarily the big problem was these vaccine mandates through OSHA regulations,
right?
On the entire population, private sector, and the Supreme Court struck it down because the president doesn't have that kind of authority to do that. Congress didn't pass any law that allowed it, and he can't do it. That wouldn't be the case in countries like Canada, Great Britain, Australia. In fact, we've seen much more severe lockdowns and mandates being enforced in those countries than have ever been enforced here, as bad as it's been here. Plus, we have something happening in November that's all of a sudden causing these things to go away, mask mandates and vaccine mandates in the states, because all these people are up for election and they know they got a big problem coming. And I think it's going to I don't think it's going to make much difference, but that's part of the reason why you're seeing these things being lifted now. It is also the case, I was just reading an article today, that Omicron variant, the cases are down like 90%. I mean, they're just evaporating.
Right.
And people are just, you know, it's time to just learn to live with it. We're not going to, you know, submit to these lockdowns. They're hearing that on the Democratic Party, even though they were responsible for most of this crap for the last 2 years. And so that's one reason why it's changing. But as I get back to the original point, we have constraints in our Constitution and laws that prevent presidents from using dictatorial powers, except in the most extreme circumstances. But that's not the case in some of these other countries that we like to think of as just as free as we are.
Right. Well, you know, you mentioned that, you know, and it's true, a lot of the states are finally getting rid of their lockdowns and their draconian stuff. But didn't Dopey Joe just, quote unquote, extend the COVID emergency recently? I mean, I didn't read the whole article, but I thought I read that he did reinstitute or extend the COVID emergency, calling it a crisis or whatever, but I could be wrong on how.
Well,
that,
I don't know that exactly what he's done, and he has some leeway to do things like that with respect to federal workers and the military, you know, in those limited circumstances. But what's going on here is you're seeing state after state, including a lot of Democratic run states, now lifting these mandates,
right.
And but the CDC has not. You know, and when they imposed them, they were using CDC guidance. You know, you got to wear masks, you got to, you know, distance. We need to have, you know, everybody vaccinated. All these that was the justification in a lot of these states for the lockdowns and mandates that they imposed. But now, even though the CDC hasn't yet, you know, really changed on these things, the states, for what I would call politically expedient reasons, are starting to dial that back. The government the federal government and the CDC don't have the power to impose these mandates. They make these recommendations, but then the left in particular, and a lot of these blue states, impose these lockdowns, impose these mandates based on the CDC guidance or the guidance from the federal government. The CDC has not changed yet. They're talking about whether they might. And my guess is that Biden, you know, with the election coming, Biden's going to want them to do that. But that's why you're still seeing in a lot of states mask mandates on kids in school. These kids are the least vulnerable to COVID of just about any segment of society. It's just complete insanity, I think, and a lot of them are starting to be lifted. But look at the resistance that newly elected Republican governor in Virginia, Youngkin, got when they decided they were going to end these. Well, they weren't going to. You know, what we're talking about is, you know, anybody wants to wear a mask. You want to wear a mask. You want to wear a hazmat suit. You know, go ahead. It's the mandating of it, then forcing everybody to do it. That's the problem. And to do that to like a 5-year-old, you know, it's just insane. And it's borderline cruelty.
Yeah. No. So okay, I've just pulled it up. He extended the designation of COVID-19 as a national emergency. That's all he did. He didn't, you know, he didn't extend mandates or anything like that. But here's the other thing. It said more than 900,000 people in this nation. You know what? We've been at between 900,000 and a million for a long time. In other words, they said, remember at the beginning, we're going to have 2 million people die in the next, you know, couple months. I don't think we're going to hit 2 million ever. I mean, not in our lifetime.
And also, you have to remember how they count these deaths too.
Yeah.
It turns out that a lot of, there's a difference between someone who goes in for some other reason, and then it turns out when they get tested that they've tested positive for COVID, as opposed to someone who gets sick with COVID and goes into the hospital. Yet they're all lumped together as COVID statistics.
Yep. Well, even in the Bob Saget case, they tried to, you know, he had COVID. You know, I mean,
for purposes of counting, this is the most egregious thing that I've understanding is, if someone dies in a car accident and they do a you know, post-mortem on you, and they test your blood, you turned out that you tested positive for COVID, your death will count as a COVID death.
Why would they even do it? Which begs the question, if you're a medical examiner and a body is brought in and you get the report, a police report, you know, the deceased jumped from the, you know, the 15th floor of the of their condo building or whatever their apartment, why would you even do a COVID test? You know, that's
well, you know, they do a lot of blood work on a post-mortem just as a matter of course. So apparently they're testing to see, you know, they want to get maybe they want to get an idea of how many people might have it. And, you know, so they would just know in the post-mortem in the autopsy report that person tested, you know, positive, you know, blood showed positive for COVID. It's the CDC or the National Institute of Health or something that then uses that statistic to say that's a COVID death.
Yeah.
Now I'm not saying that this is a large number of deaths, but I mean that's the kind of example of things that were happening, and what they would count as a COVID hospitalization or a COVID death.
Yeah, and it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, I don't know if I guess in our lifetime we'll quote unquote recover from it. But, I mean, seriously, you talk about kids. I mean, kids are marked for life, you know? I mean, can you see what our kids are going to be talking about and our grandkids are going to be talking about is remember back when we had that COVID stuff? Remember how – I mean, how long are we going to see people wearing masks, for instance, you know? I mean, I don't know that we'll ever undo the damage that was done. That's what I'm afraid of.
No,
I mean, I'm almost
well, – the thing is, you know, these cloth masks, there's pretty good evidence they don't really do a whole lot.
Right.
To prevent you from getting COVID. It may be true that it does help if you say you have COVID, if you're wearing a mask, you know, giving it to someone else. But the thing is that if you really want to wear a mask that works, that's going to give you some insurance that you're bulletproof on COVID, you need to wear one of those N95s, which I don't know if you've ever worn one, but that's a whole – I mean, you seal it basically – but you know what? If that prevents you from getting it, which I think they're saying it does, and that's what you should be wearing, then all these people that are nervous about getting COVID, they can buy the N95 or the KN95 and wear it, and then they're safe. So it doesn't matter whether someone else has COVID or is a threat to you, because as long as you're wearing that mask, you're okay. So, you know.
Allegedly.
More
allegedly.
Power to you.
Yeah, and that's just it.
I mean, I'm still seeing people. Mask you need to wear.
Yeah, I'm still seeing people in the stores that are wearing them, and I don't care. You know, I mean, I sometimes think, God, that's kind of out there. But I know people driving in their cars with their mask on. That's definitely out there. But I get it. Some people are just paranoid. So they've watched the wrong news sources or they've got the wrong information, and they're scared still. I don't know why. 2 years later, they're still scared, but they are.
I think a lot of it is a combination of virtue signaling combined with just a feeling like I'm doing something to maybe it's like a security blanket that makes you think you're safe. And I think it has the cloth ones have very marginal value in preventing you from getting.
I mean,
you know, I think COVID's run its course, you know, and I don't think these masks have done anything to stop it.
No, they've all but said that they didn't, you know, and that the lockdowns really didn't make a difference. I mean, it's, you know, remember when the first celebrities that announced it were Tom Hanks and his wife, and they were in Australia at the time. How convenient, but whatever. And they announced it. And I remember somebody saying, a guy from my hometown saying, you know what, don't be surprised if you start seeing the celebrities, you know, talking about getting COVID. And, you know, you've already seen it. There were several people. I remember if it was Courtney Love or someone like that, you know, some fringe entertainer who's not really a top flight celeb, but saying, you know, talking about COVID and, you know, living through the lockdown and self-quarantining and everything, and then finding out, well, no, I don't know that I actually had COVID, but the quarantining and all this stuff was just brutal. Well, really? You know, I mean, it's, if you don't have it, why are you doing that? That's what and you're right. The virtue signaling, I think, has been a huge part of it. But yeah, I mean,
I think that's right.
I mean, it's almost like stolen valor. It's the person who wears, you know, combat fatigues, you know, around town, and then you find out, well, this person was never actually in the service. He just went to a surplus store and bought a bunch of fatigues. Well, that's a little worse maybe, but it's the same general idea of, you know, it's stolen valor. It's stolen. It's attention seeking. It's me. And that's a pretty sick thing to contemplate.
When these things first started, you know, when you had the lockdowns and how that severely that was affecting the economy and just your, and it, you know, having any kind of freedom to do anything in life, you know, I never thought in a million years that would happen. And the masks were sort of used, you know, going back now a year and a half, you know, maybe 2020.
We're talking 2 years
now. They were the vehicle through which, well, if you wear the mask, then if we're all wearing masks, then we can, you know, you can go back into the stores and the restaurants and places of work and stuff like that, you know.
Yep.
Although you think about it, restaurants are always an absurdity. You'd wear a mask in the restaurant, and then the minute you sat down, and 95% of your time, you're not wearing a mask. So you just have to have it to go in until you got seated or until you walked out the door. I mean, it was ridiculous if you think about it. But that was the only way you could keep restaurants open. But anyway, so the masks were a vehicle for a while as how we can sort of, you know. And I was like, hey, you know, if wearing a mask, it means things are going to open up and you can at least go about your business. All right, fine. But I mean, then it's just, you know, we're 2 years into it. I mean, I think there's some people that would want us to mask perpetually anytime we're out in public and outdoors, too, which is just totally, you know, there's no science to support it.
No,
but
there isn't.
Anyway, people got hooked on this belief that masks were the way to save your life.
They got hooked on the virtue signaling. They got hooked on the control aspect. I mean,
right.
You know, as I said, flying to my daughter's wedding and them saying, you know, you got to keep your mask on except for sips and nibbles. You know, you can't, you know, even for just talking, you got to keep your mask on. And then they said, we can all get through this together. And it's like, yeah, as I'm looking about the plane and realizing they have crammed 288 people into this thing. And thinking that the mask is what's going to stop it, you know, I mean, come on. And yet, you know what? There's too many people that believe that and actually live that. And that's where I'm saying, I don't know that we'll ever come back from that portion of it. There is a far too large percentage of our population that is willing to put up with that kind of stuff. That's frightening.
Right.
I mean,
God forbid
we do have to go to war. I don't know that we're equipped to do it, you know.
Well,
I mean, emotionally,
here's an important point, though, I think, about this, and that is, like, about half the country, you know, red state America, you might call it, basically never went down this path, or they did just very briefly, and then that was the end of it. So places like where you're at in Florida, or a lot, you know, any red state, you go to my home state of Iowa, they basically, you know, and I was back there last July, you would never know that there was any kind of COVID epidemic because no one was wearing masks. There were no restrictions and life was normal. And in red state America, that's pretty much been the way it's been for the last year and a half. It's in the blue states where they've maintained all this stuff.
Yep.
And you know, and maybe the populations in those states were more, you know, compliant and willing to do it. I think if there had been a way to try to impose these kinds of mandates and lockdowns nationwide, that you would have seen much more unrest, particularly in the red states. They weren't going to put up with it, but they haven't had to. So that's one thing that's one, you have to make a distinction. There's kind of, you know, as far as the way COVID was dealt with, there's kind of like a bifurcation of the country and one country,
one,
the red state America, things were pretty much free or have been certainly for the last year. And blue state America until just recently, you know, that's been anything but freedom.
Yep. You know, Indy Hawk pointed something out too, by the way. Over 75%, this is a CDC director that said this, over 75% of COVID deaths occurred in people with at least four comorbidities. Four. But we're not hearing that at all. You know, that's nowhere on the radar in mainstream media.
Right. No, I mean, there's been a real, you know, well, it doesn't play into the narrative, you know. We know what that's about.
Yep, exactly. So, hey, we're coming up on it, and I wanted to play your song in its entirety. So stay on the line so you can hear it, of course. But thanks for being on, and thanks for the insight on Ukraine. God forbid it gets to the point where we're involved.
Stay tuned on that. It's going to get pretty interesting.
Yep. So, folks, before I leave, I'm going to put Mike's song on. I want to thank Indy Hawk and Annie from Southern Sense Radio and T. Bodie for being here. Mike and Brother Tommy and all their listeners, Mrs. Hank and our little Aussie. Sue from New Mexico has been on the whole time. Thank you, Sue. For those of you that follow me on Twitter, you'll notice that in my initial, when I post, I've always included Sue in there because Sue is a huge supporter of not only the show, but Global Patriot Radio. So if you ever want to, you know, understand what support is, go follow Sue on Twitter, Sue from New Mexico, because she's a huge supporter and a huge truth seeker. So, hey, Mike, we'll talk to you later. And here comes your song.
Was alone, I took a ride, I didn't know what I would find there. Another road where maybe I could find another kind of mind there. Ooh, then I suddenly see you. Ooh, did I tell you I need you every single day of my life? You didn't run, you didn't hide, you knew I wanted just to hold you. And had you gone, you knew in time we'd meet again, for I'd have told you. Ooh, you were meant to be near me, ooh, and I want you to hear me say we'll be together every day. What can I do, what can I be when I'm with you? I wanna stay there. If I am true, I'll never leave. And if I do, I know the way there. Ooh, then I suddenly see you. Ooh, did I tell you I need you every single day of my life?
Good night, all. Thanks for being here.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.